Welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the city of Cologne, today's Western Germany, that is over 2,000 years old. But until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past. Hence it is full of events and narrations that represent European history like a microcosm. In the last episode, we entered Frankish Cologne on foot as a traveler. What awaits you this episode? Well, the big game. Politics, kings and murders, and a Frankish king to form one of the biggest empires since the fall of Rome. Before we start into the main part of this episode, presenting this episode's random fact about Cologne. The Hohe Straße, or as it was called in ancient times, the Carder Maximus, Cologne's most important north-south street, has to be cleaned 12 times a day. The constant flow of people strolling through today's pedestrian zone and perhaps a lack of trash cans and human decency probably makes this necessary. By the way, only 6% of all Cologne residents consider their city as clean, which is clearly different from the opinion of my foreign friends who always describe Cologne and Germany itself as extremely clean. But that is of course only my own assessment. Let's hit the intro. Probably since the year 470, King Sigibert ruled his small empire at the Rhine from Cologne. Perhaps you notice that I do not give exact territorial data here. The reason is simple. We do not know exactly how far the empire of the so-called Rhine Franks extended. The name Rhine Franks comes from the fact that several different sub-kingdoms of the Franks were founded on the territory of the former Western Roman Empire. For a long time, research has assumed a kind of Frankish dualism that means that there were two big Frankish empires or kingdoms. On the lower Rhine, on both sides, ruled the tribe of the Rhine Franks, or also called the Cologne Franks. The other Frankish empire was that of the Sale Frankish, which is more famous in history, and you will learn why pretty soon. It was located in the northwest of Cologne in the Belgian-Dutch border region between the rivers Maas, Dele and Schelde. By the pronunciation of these rivers, you can hear now well out that I have also Dutch in my blood. So these were the two great Frankish kingdoms which had established themselves after the end of Rome in Gaul and in the Rhineland. Meanwhile, however, research is certain that, as always, the political map was far more complex. Frankish rule on the Rhine and in Gaul was far more diffuse and fragmented than had previously been assumed. For the salvation of us all, however, and for the smooth progress of this podcast, I will continue to tell the story in such a way that there were only these two Frankish kingdoms. But keep in mind, though, that it was much more nuanced than that. But for narrative, fortunately, this does not detract. In spite of the fragmentation of the Frankish domains, it was already evident by the end of the 5th century that one Frankish ruling dynasty was becoming more and more dominant. It was the Merovingian dynasty. Their legendary king, Merovech, founded this Frankish ruling dynasty in the middle of the 5th century. He was one of the Frankish military leaders in Roman service who took advantage of the end of Western Roman Gaul to found their own independent empire near the city of Tournai in present-day Belgium. Whether this Merovech lived at all is not known, some historians therefore classify him in the realm of legends. However, he might not have lived long. Already in the year 463, his son Childerich ruled. Childerich, or Childeric, how you say it in English, is a historically secured person. By a stroke of luck, his grave was found in the year 1653 when a hospice was to be built there. In the unplundered grave of Childerich, numerous splendid grave goods were found, among them more than 300 golden bee figures. Unfortunately, only two of these bees have been preserved and almost nothing of the treasure itself has survived, because in 1831 thieves managed to steal almost all the treasures from Schilderich's tomb from the National Library in Paris. The robbers melted down almost everything in order to better sell the stolen goods. What a horrible loss. Fortunately, numerous and extensive illustrations were made of the finds, so we still have a good overview today. But yes, Schilderich is the first Frankish king from the Merovingian dynasty we have historical evidence of. Now it gets more complicated. Remember the two Frankish kingdoms, that of the Salian Franks, of the one that Schilderich ruled, and that of the Rhine Franks. By the way, a map is certainly helpful for this. I posted it in the companion post of this episode. Link to it, as always, in the show notes. The kingdom of the Salian Franks was ruled by Schilderich and then by his descendants. Here the Merovingians had also sprung under their founder Merovich. The kingdom of the Rhine Franks around Cologne was again ruled by Sigibert. The research is widely agreed that Sigibert did not come from the Merovingian family. Nevertheless, there are some who see a family lineage to the Merovingians. Be it so. We have now introduced the Merovingian dynasty, likewise the two Frankish kingdoms. Sigibert and Schilderich called themselves respectively in Latin Rex, so king. But we should not imagine those two rulers with golden crowns and ermine coats on a golden throne in a huge castle. Even these so-called kingdoms of the Franks were only regional dominions. If you consider how large the kingdoms of the Rhine Franks and the South Franks were in the beginning, you will quickly realize this is exactly the distance that can be easily reached by horse within 1 or 2 days. So the title of a king is much too high for these Frankish rulers. They are rather small local warlords who went out with the troops in spring to make booty for themselves and their retinue. While the Rhine Franks moved further and further south along the Rhine, the Salian Franks extended their dominion deeper west into Gaul. However, all these Frankish subkingdoms seem to have worked loosely together in one way or another. Thus, Sigibert and Schilderich, as well as numerous other Frankish warlords, ruled over their respective kingdoms, but there was no great effort by either side to eliminate the other. Or, no one was successful in doing that. At least not in the beginning. Then, however, in 481, Schilderich, the ruler of the Salian Franks, died. His son Chlodwig, or Clovis as he is called in English, was of a completely different nature. From his still small dominion in today's Belgium, Chlodwig moved westward and in 486 conquered the kingdom of Suagrius in northern Gaul, which was still under Gallo-Roman rule. Suagrius, as a Roman, had ruled his own largely still Roman-dominated empire in northern Gaul, and man is that a difficult name to pronounce in English. However, Suagrius has no chance against the devious Chlodwig. His empire is conquered by the Salian Franks under his rule. Among them also the city of Parisia, which grew rapidly in late antiquity. Of course, I don't have to translate that for you. Parisia is the present French capital, Paris. Already in the year 508, Chlodwig declared Paris his preferred residence. Chlodwig is extremely busy. Among his kin, he now begins to murder his rivals one by one, and most of them were his family members. It is a time when rulers do not yet linger lazily in their castle. Here they still work with their own hands. Thus it is known that Chlodwig killed his relatives partly by his own hand. This is probably what happened to a Frankish warlord named Ragnachar of Cambrai, who made a fatal acquaintance with Chlodwig's axe. But Chlodwig could not expand his power entirely without help. He was still dependent on Frankish allies. This he found in the very Sigibert of Cologne, who was staying in a praetorium in the city on the Rhine as the ruler of the Rhine Franks. In the episode about the approaching end of the Roman rule at the Rhine, I have particularly illuminated two Germanic tribes. On the one hand, logically the Franks. On the other hand, the Alemanni. In case you're wondering what happened to the Alemanni after all that time, well, their story was quite similar. They too had built up and expanded their dominion on the Upper Rhine in the south of today's Germany after the end of the Roman rule. But now they got into a conflict, especially with the Rhine Franks, for the supremacy in the region. In 496, Sigibert therefore asked his ally Chlodwig if he could help him in the war against the Alemanni. In the Battle of Zülpich, or Zülpich, a place south of Cologne which we have heard about several times now in the course of this podcast and still will, the combined forces of the Salian and the Rhine Franks decisively defeated the Alemanni. I say this without much exaggeration. The outcome of this battle had, if not world historical, then nevertheless European historical dimensions. In the battle, Chlodwig in particular had distinguished himself among the Frankish troops. It had been clear to many Cologne Franks that they would not have managed to stop the Alemanni without his, or so Chlodwig's, help. This also strengthened Chlodwig's political position among the Rhine Franks. The actual ruler of the Rhine Franks, the aging Sigibert, had in turn been wounded in this battle. He was never to fully recover from his injuries and from then on was derisively called Sigibert the Lame. In contrast to this stood Chlodwig, who had excelled in battle like an Achilles. Yes, that's right, in the early Middle Ages, noble rulers still fought in battles themselves. Why did he do that? Well, Chlodwig probably believed in divine providence. I hope you remember the last episode. The Franks had remained faithful to their Germanic pagan gods until the 6th century. As a pagan ruling elite in areas of the former Roman Empire, like in the Rhineland or in Gaul, they, the Franks, ruled over largely Christian native population. During the battle, the pagan Chlodwig had a flash of inspiration. He is said to have called upon the Christian God during the battle to be baptized in the event of his victory. Lo and behold, shortly thereafter, the king of the Alemanni, whose name is not known in historical research, fell in the ongoing battle. The alliance of the Salian Franks and Rhine Franks had won the battle at Zülpich. That is what made the outcome of this battle such a significant historical event. Well, you might think, Chlodwig had himself baptized, what's the big deal here? Like the Romans, we in the West largely have the idea these days that religion is a private matter. Only through our family are we largely influenced in our religious beliefs. With the Franks, however, things were different. Here the king dictated which religion was followed by the Frankish people. When Chlodwig had himself baptized as a Catholic in the same year, the year of 496, in the Cathedral of Reims, he not only adopted the religion of the majority of his conquered subjects, the entire Frankish ruling elite also converted to the Catholic faith of Christianity. According to the Gallo-Roman bishop and chronicler Gregory of Tours, over 3,000 Frankish nobles did so. The Franks themselves, completely in keeping with their understanding of tribalism, set out to Christianize their subjects with collective baptisms. If you're an attentive listener to this podcast, you will see clear parallels to the Roman Emperor Constantine the Great. He had done exactly the same thing nearly 200 years earlier. On the eve of a battle, he had sworn to the Christian God that if he won, he would convert to Christianity. Chlodwig was aware of the parallel and staged it accordingly. Chlodwig's baptism, as a result of the Battle of Zülpich in 496, had a much greater impact than the conquest of the Alemannic territories, which was also carried out, could ever have. In Christian-influenced Cologne, the center of early Christianity in the Rhineland, and numerous church structures still originating from Roman times, this event will have been followed with joy. It considerably reduced the religious tensions between the local Christian Roman population and the previous pagan Frankish rulers. Then as now, as well as throughout the course of human history, religious tensions are the kindling that can bring whole societies to ruin. Chlodwig also recognized this, and did this nevertheless probably rather from more pragmatic than from personal religious reasons. Why I claim this? it would be several decades before the Franks would finally abandon their pagan roots. Here come again with Graves. They are just a reliable historical source for us 1500 years later. Franks have themselves buried in this time, both with Christian symbolism and rites. The grave goods originating from pagan conviction, like weapons, food and jewelry, one gave nevertheless still in addition, just to be on the safe side, in case the Christian god should turn out to be a misconception. But wait, surely it was only the Salian Franks who converted, and not the Rhine Franks around Cologne and the Sigibert, right? Well, just listen, the story should quickly unravel. Not long after the Battle of Zülpich, we don't know the exact order of chronology, Clotilde felt powerful enough to conquer the sub-kingdom of the Rhine Franks as well, so also our Cologne. And he did so in his usual way. To the son of Sigibert, named Cloderich, by the way, aren't the Frankish names of this time wonderful? He instigated patricide. Cloderich's father, Sigibert, was nevertheless much too old and decrepit as a lame. With the murder, Cloderich could immediately become the king of the Rhine Franks, and Clotilde held out the prospect of a friendship alliance to Cloderich. But let us use the rare opportunity to have a reasonably contemporary written source. It is the records of the historian and Bishop Gregory of Tours. We have encountered him before in the course of this podcast when we talked about Saint Severin and Saint Martin. Gregory wasn't born until the year 538, so wasn't there alive, but it's the best we have as a written source from that time. Let's listen to him, Book 2, Chapter 40. Quote, "When King Clotilde was dwelling at Paris, he secretly sent to the son of Sigibert, saying, 'Behold, your father has become an old man and limps in his weak foot. If he should die,' he said, 'of due right his kingdom would be yours together with our friendship.' Led on by greed, the son plotted to kill his father, and when his father went out from the city of Cologne and crossed the Rhine and was intending to journey through the wood, Buchhof, as he slept at midday in his tent, his son sent assassins in against him and killed him there, in the idea that he would get his kingdom." End quote. It is not surprising, therefore, that Cloderich was nicknamed the Patricide. Quickly, Cloderich secured his father's treasure and declared himself his father's successor. To Clotilde, he sent word that Sigibert was dead and invited the king of the Salian Franks to Cologne to meet him. Some messengers of Clotilde hurried ahead of their master to Cologne. Cloderich proudly showed them the treasure he had snatched from his murdered father. But when Cloderich bent too low over one of the treasure chests, one of the messengers took his axe and slew it in the unsuspecting Cloderich with it. Like father, like son. At the same time, Clotilde had other minor Frankish rulers eliminated, like the already mentioned Ragnachar, whom he even killed with his own axe, as well as Chararich, another warlord from the South Frankish region. Those Merovingian names are great, aren't they? Both were, of course, relatives of Clotilde. By eliminating all these and other competitors, Clotilde had erased all competition within a few years. For the first time in the history of the Franks, a single man could now claim dominion over all Frankish kingdoms. And that is what Clotilde did. A few days after the murder of Cloderich, Clotilde himself arrived in Cologne. Of course the people of Cologne were not stupid. They knew exactly who had killed their last two kings in a short time. But why should this bother Cologne people now? Clotilde was now the man of the hour. He had proven himself to be the protector of Cologne in the Battle of Zülpich, and had expanded his empire to a great extent. Clotilde himself stood before the crowd in Cologne and protested his innocence. It was absurd anyway to suspect him of the murder of all these men. They were members of his family. And you don't kill your own family members? That would be a sin, wouldn't it? At the gates of Cologne, directly in front of the church of Saint Gerion, Clotilde, now Christian, had himself raised on a shield by the nobles of the Rhine Franks, those who were still alive, They swore allegiance to him and proclaimed him the king of all the Franks. Until his death in the year 511, not so long after his elevation to king of all Franks, he conquered the remaining territories of the Alemanni on the Upper Rhine and almost incidentally drove the Visigoths out of Gaul between 507 to 509. So when Clotwig died in the year 511, he had created a large empire out of the small dominion of the Salian Franks which he had taken over in 481. With killing all of his rivals and expanding his territory, Clotwig established the Frankish Empire of the Merovingians, named after the dynasty from which Clotwig and his successors came. From his father Childerich, Clotwig had inherited only a small territory on what is now the Belgian-Dutch border. When he died 30 years later, the Merovingian Empire included the entire Rhineland. The Alemanni had been subjugated. All of Gaul except for the southeast was in Frankish hands. They were allied with the distant Byzantine Empire. Roman and Germanic law had been merged in parts, and the entire Frankish elite had converted to Catholic Christianity. Especially with the conversion of the Franks to Catholic Christianity, Clotwig had reconciled and united the old, still existing power elite, mostly in the form of the Roman Catholic Church with the new Frankish power elite. With his conversion to Catholicism, Clotwig could rely on the church as an additional pillar of power in his kingdom, and he made ample use of it. His connection to the church went so far that he had great influence on who would become a bishop in his kingdom. As a historian, one should not praise, a lecturer at the University of Bonn once told me, but it is nevertheless no exaggeration to say that Clotwig accomplished a great deal, and especially reshaped Central Europe so that it became what it is today. The further course of our history here will clearly show that. Don't worry, I will also post a map of the Merovingian Empire, the Frankish Empire that Clotwig founded, in the companion post of this episode. But if you already know about Europe because of good geographic knowledge, you will notice that Clotwig had conquered no less than large parts of what is now France, Western and Southern Germany, and large parts of Luxembourg, the Netherlands and Belgium. What did this mean for Cologne? When Cologne became part of the great Frankish Empire under Clotwig, it was once again what it had already been in Roman times, a city on the outskirts. But maps can be deceptive. After all, Cologne continued to be centrally located in the Rhineland and was still the center of all Roman roads in the region. Thus, Cologne continued to be an important city in the Frankish Empire. The fact that we have hardly any written sources from this time and instead have to rely on the study of graves for the development of this period is typical for this time. Due to the lack of written sources, for a long time historical research held the opinion that Cologne had been insignificant and would only become important again in the following centuries. This has been proven to be nonsense in more recent times. The findings from the excavations of the last decades presented in the last episode have created a completely opposite picture. With its long-distance road network, an intact settlement structure and the Rhine as a traffic route, it remained an important city in the Frankish Empire of the Merovingians. The city of Reims in present-day France has also been proven to have been an important residence city. It was here that Clotwig had himself baptized. Later, the French kings would have themselves crowned here, but we have hardly any written evidence of this place from the time of the 6th and 7th century, just as with Cologne. Let us take a look at how Cologne was ruled in the Frankish Empire of the Merovingians. As barbaric as the Franks were described by the Romans, nevertheless, the Frankish kingdom under Clotwig was very orderly. In a large empire, it was of course no longer possible as king of all the Franks to be present everywhere and to exercise the affairs of government directly on the spot. The empire was divided in so-called Gaue, similar to what we call districts today or counties. Each Gau or county had its own administration which was subordinate to the king. Cologne, of course, formed its own county. At the head of each county was a governor, as in Roman times. The title of governor was based on the Roman tradition. The highest royal official was simply called comes, Latin for count. The duties of the count, who had his official residence in the Praetorian Cologne, were not very unfamiliar with the classic work of a Roman governor. Defense, enforcing, speaking and promulgating law, collecting taxes, maintaining military and civil infrastructure, and of course, ensuring that troops were available when the king called for a war campaign. Each count was expected to maintain a defined contingent of troops. When collecting taxes, one-third were at the count's disposal for his own needs and, of course, to carry out his duties imposed by the king. However, two-thirds went to the king's court, wherever he was staying at that time. The reigning Frankish king was always traveling. He literally ruled his kingdom from horseback. There was no single capital as in the Roman Empire. The Frankish Empire was therefore covered with residences where the king would travel to and stay for a while doing his business until he moved to the next one. These were at that time, at Chlodwig's time, mainly Paris, Reims, Metz, Orléans and Soissons. I can't speak French, sorry. A king commuted back and forth between these during his reign. But still, this is not enough to rule a kingdom like that. The Frankish administration was diligently supported by an institution that had survived the end of the Roman Empire, dating back to ancient times, the Roman Catholic Church. When the Franks took over rule in parts of Gaul and the Rhineland around the year 450, they found a largely intact Roman episcopal administration. Already in late Roman times, administrative tasks had been handed over to the bishoprics, or when local Roman power broke down, they had filled the administrative power vacuum. The leading positions within the bishoprics were filled by the Gallo-Roman elite. By the way, the fact that Roman Catholic priests and bishops were not allowed to marry was far from being the rule yet. The fact that the Gallo-Romans occupied the posts in the church structure remained even in Frankish times. The Franks gratefully accepted the still existing state structures in the conquered territories, which the churches and bishoprics had once taken over in the crumbling state power of the Roman Empire itself. However, the church was not yet as powerful as it was to become in the further course of the Middle Ages. And there's a good example of that, especially for Cologne, that the church was not as all-powerful as it would be later. Even sometime after the reign of the Christian Chlodwig, the population of Cologne was still pagan to a not insignificant extent. The following incident, which is said to have taken place in the city in the year 520, testifies to this. Be prepared to another set of great Merovingian Frankish names. In that year, Teuderich, a son of Chlodwig who had died 9 years before, came to Cologne with his retinue, among the entourage were, of course, clergymen. Among them was a bishop from Clermont, a city in present-day France, and this bishop was called Gallus. Here too, Gregory of Tours reports what happened next. Bishop Gallus learned that there was a pagan temple in the city. The temple, Gregor of Tours reports, was crammed full of food and drink. Inside, the non-Roman inhabitants from the surrounding countryside would offer offerings to the idols of their gods. To relieve physical ailments, the respective pagan believer was supposed to carve the part of his body where he was in pain in wood and hang it in there in the temple. When the bishop Gallus heard this, he showed little religious tolerance. Rather the absolute opposite. Personally, only with the help of another priest, he attacked the temple and set it on fire. A truly spiritual arsonist, as a proverb in German would say. Well, this truly fiery temper was to almost cost the life of the Bishop of Clermont. Word quickly spread among the city's pagan citizens that a Christian firebug had torched one of their temples. The bishop and his priestly accomplice had to literally run for their lives. Fortunately for themselves, they made it to the safety of the Praetorium, where Teuderich resided for the duration of his stay. This little story shows us, the church and the Frankish king were already working closely together. This often had practical reasons as well. The largely Gallo-Roman priests and clergy were able to read and write. The Frankish elite, however, mostly did not. This does not mean that they did not appreciate the meaning and usefulness of writing. Latin was valued as a scholarly language. Remember, the Franks never wanted to destroy the Roman Empire, they wanted to be a part of it. The Latin language had a uniform structure and broad sections of the people in the Frankish Empire of the Merovingians still knew the language well enough, no matter if you were in Gaul or in the Rhineland. Thus, despite the fall of Rome, Latin was the language found in almost all documents until well into modern times. During his reign from 482 to 511, King Chlodwig had legal texts of the Romans and the Franks, in particular collected, arranged and revised. It would be a much too big topic actually, but the so-called Lex Salica, which was created at the instigation of Chlodwig, is a first great attempt to harmonize Germanic law and Roman law. The Latin text of this collection of laws has survived to our own time, to the chagrin of many students of history who were tormented with it in their introductory lecture at university, like me. This makes the Lex Salica, the Law of the South Franks translated, one of the oldest legal texts preserved to this day. I would love to put a link to the Lex Salica in the companion post of this podcast, but besides Latin and a German translation, I'm afraid I haven't found an English translation on the internet. Maybe we'll get into that in the next episode. We can simply apply individual passages from it to everyday occurrences in a city, and then I translate it for you. Like shoplifting, for example. But long story short, such a collection of laws in this period of the early Middle Ages needed the help of clergymen. First, because they were able to read and write. Secondly, because as Gallo-Romans, they also still had a good knowledge of the old Roman legal texts. The historically proven incident of the arsonist bishop and the fact that a pagan mob dared to chase him through Cologne as a reaction to this shows that Christianization was far from complete at the beginning of the 6th century, at least here in Cologne and in the Rhineland. Perhaps we should now conclude this episode. There is still so much to tell from Frankish Cologne. Therefore, we will dedicate ourselves to some more aspects in the next episode. How was urban society in Frankish Cologne actually organized? Then I must urgently address the promised aspect of further Christianization. Just as in Roman times, a city like Cologne also lived off its surrounding countryside, which fed it. We should take a look at that as well. And what happened to Cologne in general in the Frankish Empire? I will discuss all this in the next episode. Don't worry, it will be more interesting than it may sound at first glance. Until then, be well, stay faithful to my podcast, and until then, auf Wiedersehen. P.S. Oh yes, Chlodwig is still extremely present in the cityscape today. The Chlodwigplatz, the Square of Clovis, is nowadays a lively square and connects the already mentioned Severance Quarter with the Southern Quarter. It is the place of numerous owner-operated bars and restaurants, a medieval city gate, and as the place of the start of the Cologne Carnival parades. Really, everyone in Cologne knows the Chlodwigplatz. But always keep your eyes open. This square is so busy that either a bicycle, a car, or right away a streetcar weighing several tons could run you over. But at Christmas time, the square there is really beautifully lit and invites you to linger. With a mulled wine, then even a little bit better from my own experience.